An update as it relates to Jazz Beck. We asked you to pray last week, and dramatic improvement this week, and he's home and doing much better. So thank you for your prayers, and the Lord has heard them and he's answered them. He always answers them, but we're grateful for those answers this week. The book of Acts, chapter 23, is on Sunday night. We make our way through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. The Apostle Paul has come to Jerusalem with the desire that if he could just get a chance to speak to the Jewish people, what he would say to them, him knowing them so well and having the same kind of heart for God, but the same kind of misguided zeal, that, man, if he just had a chance to tell them about what he knew and the reason for his faith in the Lord Jesus, that surely they would all be open to it and their response would be the same as his. And he goes to Jerusalem, and his arrival there in the area of the temple results in a riot. Then when he finally gets his chance to speak to them, it produces a second riot, a riot to such a degree that the Roman centurions have to go down with their forces in force to remove him from the riot that's been produced because the Jews are intent upon killing him. And the Roman governor there at the Antonia Fortress, which sits on the northwest corner of the Temple Mount, and there, built there by the Romans by design so that they could oversee the Temple Mount area and deal with any kind of religious riot or problem there during the Jewish religious holidays because of the size of the groups that were there. Josephus tells us between 1 and 2 million people. And the Romans were very conscious of law and order, and they knew that no crowd could go into a greater kind of anarchy more quickly and be more dangerous to peace and order than a religious crowd, and so they kept quite a force there. And because the Roman official there was unaware of why they were beating Paul, he commanded both Paul and the rulers, the religious rulers of the Jews, to come the following day and to bring their charges against Paul under Roman law, which means you don't take people and beat them to death on the grounds of the temple. We have a law and order here, and so you bring your accusations to a courtroom, and you bring your eyewitnesses to, you know, corroborating those accusations, and then we make judgment as it relates to these things. And so this is the scene as we enter into chapter 23. And then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, and I love those words, looking earnestly. Now you see, Paul, he's in before what is known as the Jewish Sanhedrin. It is the 70 most powerful men, in religious men in all of Israel. And he's standing in front of them, and he's not cowering. He's looking at them earnestly. Because despite the beating that he had taken the day before, and the two riots that had resulted as a result of his presence there in Jerusalem, he sees that he's standing in front of the Sanhedrin, and he figures, maybe this is why I'm here. So he's all pumped again. It's going to be a third riot. But I mean, he every opportunity, he just figures, all right, God's going to do it here. You know, God bless him for that, that kind of expectation. So he looks at them earnestly, and he said, men and brethren, I have lived in good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by. Ananias is overseeing the Sanhedrin. He commanded those attendants by him to strike Paul on the mouth. Now you picture that. Here's Paul. He's just beginning his address to this religious body, and somebody smacks him in the mouth. Now, why does he get smacked in the mouth here? Well, there could be a couple of reasons here. One of the things is that when Paul addresses this council, he addresses them as men and brethren. He talks to them as equals. And there is considerable evidence for the fact that Paul was once a member of the Sanhedrin, once one of the most powerful 70 men in all of Israel. Because at one point in his life, as he speaks about his testimony, he declared that there was a time when he consented to the death of Stephen. And that word consented is with the idea of voting toward it. And it was the Sanhedrin that had the power to vote toward that. And so he looks at that Sanhedrin and he looks at these 70 men. Some of them he recognizes from 20 plus years ago. Some are the new faces. But he sees no gulf between he and they. So he calls them men and he calls them brethren. Now here's the problem. The protocol of the day was when you stood before the Sanhedrin, you addressed them as father. That's why Jesus spoke and he said, call no man father. And so here's Paul. He says, men and brethren. So he speaks to them as an equal. And then he declares, I have lived in good conscience before God until this day. Paul is very, I don't think he's being clever here. He has the capacity for it. But he's just speaking what's on his heart. But what he is essentially declaring before the trial ever begins is how the trial ought to end. That he's completely innocent. And he is in essence communicating to them, whatever you deem me guilty of and however you judge me, I know that before God, and before God is all that matters in this life and the life to come, I have lived before him with a good conscience. I have been faithful to his word and in my personal relationship with him. But one of these two things, it appears, offended the high priest, because his meeting has been hijacked, essentially, in the best sense of the word. And so he takes here and he's offended by it, and he orders Paul to be struck. Now, Paul had a fairly low tolerance for hypocrisy. And so in verse 3, he said to the high priest, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Now, those of you who have a trouble with your temper, don't be underlining this passage. We'll talk about this in just a moment. All right. Man, all those things I've been saying to those drivers around me on 580, 680. It's right here in the Bible. Is that what he's going on here? And then his what gets him upset here is, for you sit to judge me according to the law. You give the appearance of judging people that come before this courtroom under the law of God, and then you command me to be struck contrary to the law. So it says you give the appearance of one thing and then you do something entirely different. That's called hypocrisy, and Paul didn't suffer it well. Now, to call somebody a whitewashed wall, the only walls that were whitewashed in those days were essentially tombstones. And what they would do, and this is of course during a time of a feast time, and when all these pilgrims would be coming from all around the world, these millions of pilgrims from every part of the world, if you were coming, let's say, from Morocco, or if you were coming from Syria, if you were coming from Turkey or Greece or Italy, and I mean the one time in your life you get to come to the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Pentecost, or the Feast of Tabernacles, and here you are, you're coming closer to the city and closer to the city, and you're going to go into the temple and you're going to worship the Lord there and all, and on your way you happen to walk through a cemetery and you don't know it's a cemetery, and you're walking on the ground that's covering dead bodies. According to the interpretation of Jewish law, it rendered you unclean. So here's this your great moment in your life, the thing you've dreamed of, and now you're unclean for the day to go into the temple. And so what the Jews would do is they would get white paint, whitewash, and they would whitewash all of the tombs. And so for us, we bury in the ground. We got tons of land here. But there you'd be planted in these caves and in these kind of sepulchres that they would set up. And so they would whitewash the walls saying, hey, these aren't just openings in the wall, they're dead bodies in there. Don't touch it because you'll be ceremonially unclean. And so what Paul is saying to this man is, you give a tremendous outward appearance for righteousness and for holiness, but I know the truth about you, and the truth about you is that what you are inside has nothing to do with what you appear to be. And they're two entirely different things. And to touch a tomb with a dead body was to render a person unclean. Paul was saying, you look religious, you look holy, you look like you're representing God, but not only do you not do that, but to come into contact with you is to render a person unclean spiritually. You do more harm than good. Wow. Then those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? I said, do you know who you just said that to? Nobody talks to the high priest that way, except for Jesus and you now. But anyway, and Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that it was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now he pleads innocent due to ignorance. He said, I didn't know that the person that gave the command was the high priest. He doesn't have respect for the man, but he has respect for the office. And he has respect for an order to things. And God teaches that respect, Old Testament and New Testament. Now, the fact that Paul makes this statement here bolsters a suspicion on the part of many, including myself, that the Apostle Paul had some rather significant eye problems at this time in his life and on through the rest of his life. When he wrote his letter to the church at Galatia, he wrote it in these huge letters because he wrote it himself. And he spoke to them and he said, I know that you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. And there was a disease that was prevalent in those days in that part of the world that would produce kind of a goopy kind of eye, where kind of like cataracts, it would make everything blurry and very, very difficult to see. So perhaps this is his physical condition. All he heard was the command. He responds against it, discovers that it's the high priest. And he said, listen, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have said it. And then Paul perceived that one part of the Sanhedrin were Sadducees and the other part Pharisees. And these were the two major groups of the Jewish religious community in those days. And it seems like religion all through the ages is divided into its conservative camp and its liberal camp. And so the Sadducees were the spiritual liberals of those days. And as we're going to see in a moment, they didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in resurrection. They didn't believe in the supernatural. They only believed what could be explained in their mind. And so they were they're kind of pseudo-rationalists of their day. And the problem, it sounds, you know, very, very impressive to say, you know, I only believe what it is that I can, you know, taste and feel and understand and all of that. But that's essentially the worship of the human mind. And the human mind is a wonderful thing, but it's not worthy of our worship. And so it's too small to worship. So it's essentially the worship of self. Now the Pharisees, they were the conservatives. They believed what the Bible said. They got legalistic about it. But they believed in resurrection. There was plenty of resurrection in the Old Testament. They believed in angels. There were plenty of angels in the Old Testament. They didn't get this whole liberal vibe that was going on over here. And so they were divided between the two. And Paul is here, and he recognizes that I got two different groups in here, and they believe differently on this issue called the resurrection, which happened to be very important to Paul. And so he cried out in the council, men and brethren, verse 6, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. Now, Paul is trying to build a bridge now to this religious council. He wants to talk to them about his faith in Jesus Christ. He wants to talk to them about his belief in resurrection. And the easiest group for him to build a bridge to is not the Sadducees. They're so far out in left field that I don't know how you build a bridge to them. But he says, all right, I know how to build a bridge to the Pharisees. And so that's where he begins. And he begins to speak about being a Pharisee and about a belief in the resurrection of the dead, clearly desiring to segue into speaking about Jesus. But no sooner does he say this, and then a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, for the assembly was divided. For Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a loud outcry. You can write in your margin. This is riot number three if you're counting. And the scribes of the Pharisees' party rose and they protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." Now when there arose a great dissension, this did not calm down the Sadducees. The commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces. Now he's brought all these people together and said, "All right, we're going to get down to the brass tacks here." And now he's got this guy being torn apart in another setting. And he commanded then the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. And so he is faithful to do. And Paul goes into the barracks, the Roman barracks, and he's doubtless kept in a cell there. Now you put yourself in Paul's place. When you have this enormously high expectation, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to be there for the Feast of Pentecost. I just know that God is bringing me there. And I know that if I just get a chance to speak to them, that they're going to believe. They're going to get it. All of Israel is going to understand that their Messiah has come. And now when the whole thing is played out, all he's got in his immediate rearview mirror is three riots. Things could not have turned out more differently for him than he thought. I don't know if you've ever had that happen in life. I know there's a more miserable place to have it happen than in life, and that is to have it happen in ministry and in our service to the Lord. And Paul has to be looking at what's happened, because now he is under Roman arrest. And he has to be looking at things and going, not only has all of this turned out disastrously, but now I'm arrested. And now he looks, and what's behind him is completely dismal, but what is in front of him is completely unknown to him all, too. And I think that one of the things that the Apostle Paul is dealing with as he sits in that Roman barracks is, have I destroyed God's call on my life through my self-will? Have I put myself in a place now where all of these years of tremendous effectiveness and all, have I done something here to mar God's call upon my life and His effectiveness for my life? And that is a very, very real place that all of us find ourselves in sooner or later as we serve the Lord, because all of us hit this kind of rough water. And notice what the Lord does. The following night, the Lord gave him a day and a night to think about it, not to torture him, but to let things kind of settle in. You ever let the Lord just kind of let you live with something for a little bit of time? So it just kind of sinks in. But the following night, the Lord stood by him. At times like that, where you're doubting so much and you're wondering, God, what have I done here? I thought I heard you. I thought I heard you on this. And now, Lord, I'm thinking about all those warnings that you brought to me all the way here and all this stuff that's going on and going through. And all of a sudden, you begin to think that God's a million miles away in those kind of situations. But notice, the Lord stood by him. Nobody else stood by him. Not the Sadducees. Not the Pharisees. Not the Sanhedrin. Not the myriad of Jews who believed in Jesus as the Messiah but also kept the law. Not James, not any of the leaders of the church in Jerusalem stood by him. But the Lord stood by him. And that's all that matters, really. It's nice to have all the rest of it, but that's all that matters. The Lord never gives up on us. Never gives up on us. Those times it seems like he's a million miles away, that he's washed his hands of us, that he's going to move on and do something else. It was fun while it lasted and all of that. And the Lord is more close than we can realize. The Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer. Be of good courage. Be of good boldness is literally what's being said here. Why would God tell him to be of good boldness or to be of good confidence? Because his confidence is shot. His boldness is shot. He's full of doubt now, full of fear. And he comes in and he says, be of good cheer, Paul. Well, if you're going to tell somebody in that condition to be of good cheer, you better tell them why. And the Lord does that. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. And so he said, Paul, I'm not through with you. Kind of a mess here, wasn't it? But you got to do what you wanted to do here. And now let's go back to the Gentiles, where I've called you to be a witness to me. And we're going to go to Rome now. And you're going to testify to me there. And so here is the Lord just sweetly coming in and kind of putting a healing on the things that are right behind him. No condemnation or anything. Paul, you did your best here. You bore witness to me in Jerusalem. I let you do it. But now let's go ahead. And he's given him a future. He's given him a hope now. I'm not through with you. Now we're going to go to Rome. I hope nobody in this room in your service to the Lord, whatever God has called you to, whether he's... And it doesn't mean that you got to get up behind a box like this or anything like this. God has put every single one of us in some very interesting places in this world. This last week, for a couple of times, I went to a memorial hospital late in the evening. I walk in there, and I mean, it's just a mass of people in that place. And I'm looking at these nurses, male and female, and the doctors, and the women that are manning that table as you come right in there. And I just think, every time I go in there, I just think, this is one gigantic mission field that God's people are in this hospital. And so it is no matter where we might be. I was talking with one of the sisters here this morning, and her husband has come to know the Lord recently and is just taken off in the things of the Lord. And he works at the DMV. Can you think of a more miserable place? I mean, just in the sense of just pure thanklessness. Do you know of anybody that leaves the DMV going, man, I love that place? And the lines are long and all, and you know, when I go in there, I just, okay, you go from this, and you're always in the, your first two lines are wrong. Until you get to the right, and they're all long and everything, you get up there, and you're just, oh man, and by the time you hit a human being, you know, you're just looking right through them. I mean, you're looking for the mark of the beast on their right hand or forehead. I'm just kidding. I've gone too far. But anyway, he's in there, and it's not an easy place. And he's since he's come to know the Lord, you know, the Lord has just ministered to him to each day that God has put him in that place for his glory. And so here he comes, and he looks at each person that comes there to that desk and as a creation of God and someone that he's going to be a light to and all. And as he's done that to those people, he's discovered that they have a different attitude toward him. But I mean, that's a tremendous mission field too. The sheer number of people that go through that DMV in the course of a day. Well, I don't know where I got on as it relates to all of that. But no, here it is. You have to bear with me. It won't get any better. But God has put us in all these different kinds of places. And you know, I wish we could all say at the end of 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and whatever God has called us to say, you know, there was never a difficult hour. There was never a time of second doubt. So there was never a thing where I might have gotten out ahead of the Lord a little bit and all had my doubts about His continuing to use me. This is the reality of things. God is never through with us. He's got, remember that amazing grace that we sang about. And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together, and they bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Well, that's a perky situation, isn't it? It helps put my trials in perspective. However difficult it may be, I don't know of 40, there may be four or five. in town here that have banded together, you know, and would love to see my death. But I mean, for 40 of them to just get together and say, listen, and this is essentially what they're saying, either he dies or we die. I mean, that's a fair commitment to the death of the Apostle Paul. Now, here's one of the reasons for sure that God spoke to Paul of the fact that you're going to testify to me in Rome. Because Paul, God knew that just right around the corner, there's going to be this plot that Paul's going to become aware of, and he could be worried about his physical safety. And so here is this plot that's being made against him, that they were going to kill him. Now, there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. And it wasn't just the 40. They then came to the chief priests and elders, that is the Sanhedrin, and they said, we have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. And now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow before the Sanhedrin again, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we're ready to kill him before he comes near. So they involve now the Sanhedrin in the plan or the plot to kill Paul. So you add them now to the plotters against Paul's life. And so when Paul's sister's son, that is Paul's nephew, heard, he overhears this plot of their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and he told Paul. This is the only place in the entire Bible where we read anything of Paul's family. And the beautiful thing about it is we just get one little glimpse at his nephew. And what's his nephew's heart toward his uncle? He loves his uncle. And he's concerned for his uncle's safety. I love these little pictures that God gives us of the Apostle Paul and his impact in people's lives and in his family. And so his nephew, immediately hearing this, concerned for his uncle. Now, this overhearing, verse 16, of this plot and this conversation, to me, that's completely God at work in things. It's supernatural. It's just God exposing the plot that's being made against Paul so that God can get Paul out of Jerusalem, where his ministry is clearly done, and get him on his way to Rome. Very, very often. And I think, you know, one of the things, there's not much to be said about getting older, period. I mean, there's something about the hoary head, though, the Bible talks about. But there is something wonderful about growing older in the Lord. And one of the great things about growing older in the Lord is to recognize the supernatural in the things that look like the natural to everybody else. And sometimes we think, even as Christians, we can think that the only time God is working supernaturally is if it's bombs bursting in air, he's lengthening legs, or some kind of thing like this at a healing crusade, and that represents the supernatural actions and the power of God. And I think that one of the reasons that we can tend to only to think of the supernatural only in that context is because of a dullness on our part to how much happens supernaturally, naturally around us every single day. It was no accident that his nephew heard of this plot. And then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him. And so he took him and brought him to the commander and said, Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you. And then the commander took him by the hand, went aside, and asked privately, again, a beautiful tenderness on the part of this commander. He's a Roman leader of men of valor that are beyond description. And yet he's got this young boy there and he takes him aside, knowing that so often a young person will say what they have to say a little bit easier in privacy rather than publicly. And his nephew said, the Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. Now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you. And so the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, tell no one that you have revealed these things to me. And he goes into action immediately. He called for two centurions, a centurion being a Roman officer over 100 soldiers, saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night. And so he immediately calls for 470 of the Praetorian Guard to come and become an escort to the Apostle Paul to Caesarea. And they were to be ready by the third hour of the night. Now, we measure things in the United States of America from midnight to noon, and that's kind of how we measure things. The Jews measured their time from 6 in the morning and 6 at night. So when it speaks here of the third hour of the night, that would be the third hour from 6 in the evening. So he's saying, be ready at 9 o'clock to move out. And provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. So Paul not only is going to be brought to Caesarea, but he's going to go business class. Doesn't have to walk. They're going to provide a horse for him. And he wrote a letter in the following manner. Claudius Lysias. Now remember, as we've been going through the epistles on Sunday morning, where we've talked about how Paul begins his epistles by identifying himself at the beginning of the epistle, because the letters were always in the form of a scroll. So when you open a scroll, you'd want to see right away who it was that was writing, rather than having to unscroll the whole thing. So here we see a model of those first century letters. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. And coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Now, this is known as revisionist history. This is not what happened. He didn't learn that Paul was a Roman before he rescued Paul. In fact, he didn't learn that Paul was a Roman until Paul told him of it in order that he wouldn't be scourged. So he makes no mention in writing to Felix of the fact that he had both tied Paul up as a Roman citizen and ordered his scourging, which was clearly against Roman law for Roman citizens. But, you know, the truth isn't always in letters. And so he writes it to look, you know, favorable. Well, human nature. And so he said, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council and found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains, that is, against Roman law. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. So Claudius Lysias is kind of in an uncomfortable situation as a representative of Rome there in Jerusalem, because he has arrested a Roman citizen and he is processing that Roman citizen to Caesarea, which was the Roman capital of Israel at that time. But he is sending this man in chains without any official charges against him. So the purpose of his letter is to say, listen, I know I'm sending you someone who we have imprisoned without charges, but I want you to know that the reason that we have chained him is because of public safety issues going on here in Jerusalem. And then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, which is about 20 miles out of Jerusalem toward the city of Caesarea. And the next day they left the horsemen to go on with him and return to the barracks. So these Roman soldiers, part of the Praetorian Guard, the very best among the Roman soldiers, Claudius says, be ready at night, 9 o'clock tonight, and I want you to deliver this guy to Antipatris, to Caesarea ultimately. And so these guys march, a forced march all night. Some of them are on horses, but the vast majority are walking. Overnight, a journey of 20 miles, and they deliver him. And that first 20 miles from Jerusalem to Antipatris is a lot of mountains, a lot of wooded area. It would be have been the most dangerous place to have been ambushed by the Jews. But once you get to Antipatris, the way then to Caesarea is kind of all an open area. And so they let the 400 soldiers return back to the barracks, and they said the soldiers on horseback will be enough to deliver him to Caesarea. And when they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear you when your accusers also have come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. And so again, here's Felix, and Felix is a scoundrel, as we'll see next week. Just a pure, unadulterated scoundrel. But he does have respect for Roman law. He knows he can't do anything with Paul until Paul's accusers come, because you can't establish the facts concerning a charge made against another person, much less determine the validity of those facts without both parties being involved in the process. And so he said, "We'll hold on to you and we'll send for your accusers." And Paul is held in Herod's praetorium, which wasn't bad. That city of Caesarea, one of the most beautiful places in all of Israel, we visited on the first day of our trip to Israel. And they're just uncovering it from these vast sand dunes. But they've got it all laid out for what the city was like. It was a bit of Rome away from Rome. But just, you know, fabulous in every way, in the natural kind of sense. And so Paul is kept not in harsh conditions awaiting his trial. And so we'll stop there tonight, and we'll pick things up in chapter 24. Next time. Would you turn with me to John's Gospel, chapter 19, as we prepare our hearts for communion tonight?